Chapter 8. Late in the afternoon, dark clouds, remarkably dark clouds, began gathering over the hills behind Freetown. They progressed against the wind for an hour until half the sky was black and the heat still more oppressive. Then much the same happened in the west, out at sea, but now the clouds were darker still, a fine, solid black, and as the sea breeze set in, they swallowed the low sun entirely and hurried across to cover the whole sky with a hot, lowering pall. The sea breeze also brought in five ships, dimly seen but undoubtedly men of war, bound for the Cape and India. The powder hoy that had sailed from the naval yard would certainly have been for them, and since a number of crewmen had also put off in a schooner, it was likely that among them was a merchantman, taking advantage of their protection until she turned off eastwards, trading along the grain coast, the ivory coast, and the gold coast for pepper, palm oil, elephant's teeth, and gold dust. There were some foolish rumours that the preventive squadron was back, rumours based on the bringing in and instant condemnation of the Nancy, now lying in the road. But they were dismissed on the grounds that the Nancy had been brought in by the governor's own sloop, no doubt acting as a privateer. Captain Wood, like his predecessors, could grant a commission, and who was more likely to do so than a knowing officer? Besides, who had ever heard of the preventive squadron possessing a two-decker? For even in this light, a light that might well presage the end of the world, not one, but two of these important ships could be seen.
"Thou art the father of lies," said a Syrian merchant. "Nothing whatsoever can be seen in this light, or rather this darkness visible, though I admit it is very like the death of time."
"Thou art the offspring of an impotent mole and a dissolute bat," replied his friend. "I can distinctly make out two decks on the second from the front, and on the third. They all appear to be bearing down on the Nancy."
"Balls,"
said the first merchant. But hardly were these words out before the first of the line turned to starboard, until her side was parallel with that of the Nancy, and at a distance of 200 yards she let fly with a rolling broadside whose brilliant flashes lit the whole mass of cloud, and whose voice, having deafened the town, roared to and fro among the hills. In the space of 3 astonished exclamations, no more, the whole of this was repeated, but with even greater force, with stronger, longer stabs of fire, and the deeper, louder voice of 32-pounder guns. And so it went, right along the line of ships, until the last. The silence, with powder smoke still billowing across the bay, was strangely shocking, and birds flew in every direction. But after the briefest pause, there rose a universal sound of shrill amazement from the whole wide-scattered town, followed by conjecture. It was the French. It was the Patriarch Abraham come again. It was the captain of an English man-of-war enforcing the law against slavery. He had caught the wretched Nitel of the Nancy sailing under Spanish colours, had chained him and all his men to the mast, and was now shooting and burning them to death. This explanation gained general support as the squadron wore and came back again, now thundering and bellowing two ships at a time, so that the spectators, the entire population of Freetown, could scarcely hear their own voices, though raised to a most uncommon pitch. And during the pause between this run and the next, when once again the starboard broadsides uttered their prolonged and deliberate roar, the Bellona alone flinging 726 pounds of iron at each discharge, the news spread from deafened ear to deafened ear that Kande Ngobe, who had a telescope, had clearly seen the mutilated victims in their chains. So had Amadou Ndiadje, the clear-sighted man, so had Suleiman bin Hamad, who stated that some were still alive. So was the wretched vessel, her side pierced through and through. She lay there yet, very low on the smooth sea, but since she had never showed a strake below her waterline, still afloat. Yet now, after another prodigious crescendo that lit the sky and the town, filling the streets with shadows, the line moved in for the short-range carronades to come into play, and another voice of war was heard, the high-pitched barking crack of the genuine smasher, firing much faster than the great guns, and with heavier shot than most, so fast and so heavy that the slaver could stand no more than a single passage before sliding down and down into sea, now strangely thick with sand, as thick as a moderate gruel, the result of conflict between the changing tide and a local current.
"How's your guns? How's your guns there?" the cry came down the line, and the grinning crews housed the hot cannon trim and taut. Supper was at last served out, shockingly late, and when all hands had anchored ship in 25-fathom water, the watch below turned in, still smiling, for firing live and at such a target was one of the most gratifying occupations in a seaman's life.
"No ministry could have asked for a greater éclat, a greater din,"
said Stephen, still rather loud, as they sat in the reconstituted, but still powder-smelling cabin.
"Nor a more convincing proof of the squadron's presence."
"It really was a right Guy Fawkes night," said Jack. "I'm infinitely obliged to James Wood for arranging things so cleverly and with such discretion. There were a score of details that I had not thought of at all, any one of which would have blown the gaff. That brilliant stroke of sending his own people out to bring the Nancy in, for example."
"A brilliant stroke indeed. Brilliant."
"Yes, but if the breeze sets in up the coast, as they swear it will, I believe our Guy Fawkes night will be put in the shade by tomorrow evening. I believe we may bring off such a stroke against the trade that Wilberforce and... what's his name?"
"Romilly?"
"No, the other one."
"Macaulay."
"Just so, that Wilberforce and Macaulay will skip and clap their hands and get as drunk as lords."
Well before the first dog watch the next day, all points of vantage in all the ships and vessels under Jack Aubrey's command were filled with hands gazing fixedly at the cape that closed the bay. For round it, round Cape Sierra Leone itself, their friends, who had slipped away at the height of the gunfire, should soon reappear with the present kindly breeze, bringing with them shore leave and perhaps the promise of prize money to make the leave still more delightful. But prize money to one side, it was the liberty itself that was so wonderfully desirable. There were the delights of palm trees for those who had never seen them, and the young women of the coast were said to be friendly. Chastity weighed sadly on all hands. Besides, there might be fresh fruit for the picking. But in the present state of things there was no such thing as liberty for ships moored right out in the bay. The few little blood boats and the like were fit only for one officer at a time, or at the most two thin ones. No such thing as liberty without the squadron's boats. The cheering began aboard the Aurora, most to seaward of the anchored line, and quickly it spread right along the squadron as all the boats came into view, escorting an improbable number of prizes, at least 5 schooners, 2 brigs, and a ship. The governor's sloop left harbour to guide the prizes in before the eyes of the whole assembled town, even more astonished now than they had been the night before. Never had such a catch been seen, nor even anything remotely like it. Those who had interests in the slave trade, and they were not a few, turned pale, or grey, or yellow, as was convenient, silent, haggard, and mournful, for they recognised each one of the captured vessels. They could not be mistaken. But most of the other inhabitants were excited, full of joy, smiling, talkative, not, except in the case of the crewmen, from any zeal for the abolitionist cause, but from a candid, heartfelt pleasure at the thought of the money that would flow into and out of the seamen's pockets. The bounty of £60 for a man-slave released, £30 for a woman, and £10 for a child would already mean a considerable sum from the Nancy alone. From this new and unparalleled haul it would be prodigious, even without the condemned ships themselves, and since Freetown was thoroughly used to the ways of seamen ashore, the townsmen, particularly the keepers of taverns and disorderly houses, looked forward to their coming with lively pleasure. This charming anticipation was felt even more strongly aboard, and when in answer to the Commodore's signal the Ringle and many of the boats headed for the anchorage and their mother ships, they were greeted with renewed and even stronger cheers. In a trice they would become liberty boats, ready and willing to waft Jack ashore, and several members of the watch below hurried off to beautify themselves, whilst others less sure of their deserts sought out their midshipmen or divisional officers to see what an earnest plea a becoming deference might do, and whether fourpence might be advanced. It was while the talk of coming joys was at its height that a horrid rumour began to spread. First, a sour-faced young boatswain's mate stumped into the gun-deck, plucking his best Barcelona silk handkerchief from his neck.
"No liberty," he told the world in general. "No shore leave after sunset in Sierra Leone. Doctor's fucking orders."
They told him he was wrong. The rule applied to him alone because of his ill conduct, and splay feet, and dismal Jonah face. It was nonsense to say that there should be no liberty. But presently the news was repeated so often and by so many people that it could no longer be disbelieved. No shore leave anywhere on the coast after sunset. Doctor's orders. Confirmed by Captain and Commodore.
Damn the doctor! Rot the doctor! The doctor's soul to hell!
Said the lower deck, the midshipman's berth, and the wardroom. The doctor himself, busy sewing up the radiant Hewell's arm, slashed in a brief encounter and roughly bound up with a dead slaver's shirt tail, listened to his report, his infernal verbal report to the Commodore. In consultation with the lieutenant, midshipmen and warrant officers, he had divided the flotilla into four groups of about equal strength, keeping shipmates together as much as possible, two for Sherbro and two for Manga and Lois, quite close on the mainland.
"We were to go to the western market on Sherbro first, the leading boat to paddle in, the chief crewman to hail quietly, asking was so-and-so in the way, the boat coming alongside as he talked. And the moment it touched, we hurried aboard, instantly bundling the anchor watch below, making the hatches fast and swearing they should be blown to hell if they lifted a finger, cutting the cable and putting out to sea with as pretty a breeze as you could wish. It was as easy as kiss my hand." Hewell laughed aloud. "They had no guard, no notion of any possible danger, and they made no fuss. It was the same with the next three, all prime schooners. We could hardly believe it. And so till we came to the ship. We were a little slow in getting aboard, for she was underway, with all hands on deck, and there was a little trouble. That is where I got this," nodding to his wound. "But it amounted to nothing. And having stripped Sherbro west and east, we joined the others in the offing and proceeded to Manga and Loas, where we did much the same. Though I am glad to say, sir, that there they fired on us."
"Very good,"
said Jack with satisfaction. For any vessel firing on a man of war, even if she were no larger than a four-oared cutter, was guilty of piracy and therefore forfeit, whatever its colours or nation, condemned without a word.
"But no ill effect, I trust?"
"Only a few flesh wounds, sir. For as the first brig let fly a Portuguese, the clouds parted and they saw how many we were, prizes and all. One tried to cut and run, but that did him no good. The rest, those that were awake, pulled for the shore like smoke and oakum in what boats they had alongside or in tow. So having cleared those two places, sir, we shut their people up below, put prize crews aboard, and keeping them well under our lee in case of any foolish attempt, we shaped our course for home."
"Very well done, Mr. Hewell, very well done indeed,"
said Jack. And after a pause,
"Tell me, what did you do about their papers?"
"Well, sir, I remembered what the governor said about a legal quibble getting in the way of what was obviously right, and I think they were mostly destroyed in the battle, or lost overboard. I did leave a couple of Portuguese captains' manifests and registers alone to look better. Not that it made any odds, since the Portuguese are not protected north of the line. The pirates I never troubled with, but clapped them in irons directly. And now I come to think of it, sir, there was someone in Government House, one of the gentlemen of the Vice Admiralty Court, I believe, who observed that a man who had no papers, whose ship had no papers, and who could not certainly identify the person who arrested him, was in a hopeless state. He could not make out any kind of a case at all, even with the best of counsel, and even if some foolish legal clause was in his favour."
"That was your view, I believe, Doctor,"
said Jack.
"There, Mr. Hewell," said Stephen, cutting his thread and taking no notice of the indiscretion. "There, I should advise the holding of the limb in a sling for a few days, and the avoidance of anything like excess in meat or drink. A dish of eggs for dinner, or a small grilled fish followed by a little fruit, and a small bowl of gruel before retiring, thin but not too thin, will answer very well. And this will answer very well for a sling, too," he went on, his eye having been caught by Jack's best superfine cambric neckcloth, draped over the back of a chair fresh from Killick's iron. "There," he said, inserting the wounded arm with the ease of long practice. "Now let me ask you to recommend a reliable middle-aged crewman, given neither to whimsies nor the drink, who will show me the way in Freetown, where I must go shortly after sunset. My dear Commodore, may I beg for a suitable conveyance?"
"My dear Doctor," said Jack, "I shall allow you no such thing, nor will Captain Pullings or Mr. Harding or anyone else that loves you. Was you to be seen going ashore within half an hour of forbidding the same indulgence to the entire ship's company, you would be the most hated man in the squadron. I do not say they would offer much in the way of physical violence, but their affection would be killed stone dead."
"If first thing in the morning would do, sir," said Hewell, "I have the very man, coming off with papers for me and Mr. Adams to sign about the number of slaves released. A crewman elder by the name of—" Well, their own names being hard for us to pronounce, we often call them Harry Nimble, or Fatty, or Earl Howe.
Mine is known up and down the coast as John Square, the very man for you."
Square was seaman's hyperbole, but only a pedant could have objected to rectangular, for Hewell's crewman was a very broad-shouldered, deep-chested man with short legs and long arms. His small round head was topped by greying wool, and his face bore two blue lines on the forehead, and another broader right across from ear to ear. But on him neither these nor his filed incisors looked any more bizarre than a ruffled shirt on a European. He was as black, or even blue-black, as a man could be, which gave his smile a more than usual brilliance. Yet it was clear that he was not to be trifled with in any way. He came at sunrise, paddling out in one of those flexible, apparently frail canoes that the crewmen used for landing through the monstrous surf so usual along the coast, ran up the side as nimble as a boy, saluted the quarter-deck, and called out,
"Papers for Lieutenant Hewell, sir, if you please,"
in a tremendous bass. He was perfectly willing to take Stephen ashore and show him anything he wished to see in Freetown, and as they made the passage, rising and falling on the long, heavy swell, Stephen asked him whether he knew the inland parts, the wild country, and the animals that lived there. "Yes," said he, "in his childhood he had lived part of the time at Sino, in the Crewe country on the coast. But he had an uncle who lived far up the river, and there he spent some years when he was old enough to hunt. His uncle had showed him all manner of creatures, which were lawful, which were holy, or at least protected by Juju, which were unclean, which were improper for a young unmarried man of his condition. And this knowledge, delightful and necessary in itself, proved of the greatest value later when he was engaged by a Dutch naturalist to show him the serpents of the region, an engagement that allowed him to buy his first wife, a brilliant dancer and a cook."
"Serpents alone, was it?"
"Oh, no, no, dear me, no. Elephants and shrew-mice, bats, birds, giant scorpions too, but serpents first. And when I showed him Crewe python, 3 fathom long, coiled round her eggs, he gave me 7 shillings. He was so pleased. 7 shillings, and a bright red wool hat."
"I hope he wrote a book. Oh, how I hope he wrote a book. Square, will you tell me his name now, the worthy gentleman?"
"Mr. Klopstock, sir," said Square, shaking his head. "No book."
"No book at all?"
Square shook his head again.
"Mr. Klopstock, he dead."
Poised on the back of a moderate roller, he assumed a shrunken appearance, trembled convulsively, and made the gesture of one vomiting in the last stages of yellow fever, all perfectly convincing, and all within the seconds needed for the wave to curl, run bellowing up the shore, and set the canoe down on the sand. Square stepped out, barely wetting his feet, gave Stephen a hand, and hauled the canoe above the high water mark, calling to a little crew boy to mind it and the paddle in his singular, precise English. The crew boy could make nothing of his words, however, and he was obliged to repeat them in the local dialect.
"So, no book, sir,"
said Square gravely as they walked up the strand.
"But he was a very good man, and kind to me. He taught me English, London English."
"I believe you said he was a Dutchman."
"Yes, sir, but he spoke English well, and he was happy to come here because he thought we spoke English too, London English. But he showed me prints of cobras, pangolins, and shrew-mice, or drew them himself, telling me their names in London English. So I got used to his way of talking, like missionary. Now, sir, where would you like to go?"
"I should like to see the town a little, passing the governor's house, the fort, and the market. Then I should like to see Mr. Humusius, the money-changer."
It was a wide, spreading town, with most houses lying well apart in the enclosures of their own, often with palms rising high above their walls. They met few people as they walked along, and John Square, seeing that Stephen was willing to talk, went on,
"And I knew another naturalist, sir, when I was a boy, Mr. Afzelius, a Swedish, and he spoke right careful London English, too. He was a botany. No book either, though he was here for years."
"No book, alas."
"No book, sir. When the French took the town in 1994, they burnt his house with the rest, and all his papers and his specimens. It humbugged his heart so cruelly he never wrote his book."
They both shook their heads, walking in silence for a while until, indeed, they reached the market. And as they turned the corner, they entered another world, crowded, busy, talkative, cheerful, full of colour, stalls with fruit and vegetables of every kind, brilliant in the mounting sun. Plantains, bananas, pawpaws, guavas, oranges, limes, melons, pineapples, pigeon peas, okra, cream fruit, sweet sops, coconuts, and close-woven baskets full of rice, maize, millet, grains of paradise, as well as yams and cassava and some sugarcane. Fish in gleaming plenty, tarpon, cavillers, mullets, snappers, yellowtails, old maids, 10-pounders, thought rather coarse, said Square, though nourishing, and of course great heaps of oysters. There were grave Arabs walking about, swathed in white, and a few redcoats from the fort, and most stalls had a resident dog or cat. But the world in general was black. There were, however, varying degrees of darkness, from the crewman's shining ebony to milk-chocolate brown.
"There is Zandi from Wella, right down in the Congo," said Square, nodding discreetly to just such a person, bargaining in passionate Sierra Leone English for a 10-pounder that did not, she claimed, weigh more than 8.
"Nimini pimini, nothing at all," she cried.
"And there are some Yoruba. Agbozomi, you can always tell by their tattoo. They speak you, same like Atakpami. See the Kondo tribal cuts on those cheeks, quite like the Gribo. There is a Kupwezi from here talking to a Mahi from Dahomey."
He pointed out many more and said,
"All the nations that were ever sold on the coast or round even to Mozambique live here. And there, sir, are some Nova Scotia blacks. But you know all about Nova Scotia, sir."
"I do not," said Stephen.
"Well, sir, they were slaves in America that fought on the king's side, and when the king's men were beat, they were moved to Nova Scotia. Then, after about 20 years, those that were still alive after all that snow were brought here. Some had learnt Gaelic in those parts."
"God be with them," said Stephen. "Now I should like to see Mr. Humusius, if you please."
"Aye, aye, sir, right away," said Square. "His station is at the far corner there, under the canopy, or awning, as they say."
Mr. Humusius was a Greek from some far African diaspora. He sat under his awning at a table covered with saucers holding a great variety of coins, from minute copper objects to Portuguese joes worth £4 apiece, together with delicate scales and an abacus. To his left sat a small black boy, to his right a bald dog so huge that it might have belonged to another race, a dog that took no notice of anyone at all except those who might offer to touch the table.
"Mr. Humusius," said Stephen in French, as it had been agreed long since, "good day. I have a letter of change for you."
Humusius gazed at him mildly over his spectacles, and replying in a curiously old-fashioned but perfectly fluent Levantine version of the same language, bade him welcome to Sierra Leone, looked at the document, said that he never brought such sums into the market, and, in the local English, told the boy to fetch Socrates, an aged clerk. As soon as he arrived, Humusius led Stephen to a singularly beautiful Arab house with fretted shutters and a fountain in the courtyard, and begging him to sit on a raised carpet, observed that in these particular transactions a degree of identification was called for. The doctor would forgive him for respecting this unnecessary form, but it was a superstition with people of his calling. Stephen smiled, said,
"Oh, of course,"
and felt in his pocket for some coins. He found none, and was obliged to borrow 6 English pennies. These he arranged in 2 lines, and then altered the position of 3, so that they, always being in contact with 2 others, formed a circle with the 3rd movement.
"Very good," said Humusius.
He drew a purse from under his shirt, told out 50 guineas, and said,
"I have heard from my chief that I may have the honour of receiving messages for you from time to time. Be assured that they too will rest in my bosom."
"There is another small point," said Stephen. "Can you recommend any merchants in Freetown with correspondence in Brazil or Buenos Aires?"
"Now that the trade is illegal, there is not much intercourse. But I do carry on a certain amount of banking business with export firms in Bahia. Bark, rubber, chocolate, vanilla, and the like."
"Coca leaves?"
"Certainly."
"Then please be so good as to order me an arroba of the best upland Peruvian small leaf. Here are 5 guineas as earnest money."
"By all means. I shall send at the first opportunity, and it should be here within a month or 6 weeks."
"You are very good, sir," said Stephen,
and having drunk a cup of coffee, he took his leave, pleased with the contact. So often these arrangements, these letter boxes, had a more than squalid side to them. On occasion an intelligence agent's life was very dangerous indeed, but what was in a way more wearing was that it almost always brought him into touch with dubious, often semi-criminal characters whose good fellowship and conniving smiles were profoundly disagreeable. Yet arrangements of this kind, which so often had the air of shady financial deals or adulterous correspondence, were essential. Even in a well-regulated embassy or legation or consulate, loose talk was so usual that a parallel means of communication was an absolutely necessary evil. And Maturin was certainly not going to endanger the success of the present expedition, which he rated very high, by entrusting the enterprising governor or his staff with anything in the least confidential. He found Square sitting on a stone outside, and as they walked back to the Strand, he said, "John Square, if you are not engaged for the next few weeks, I should like you to sail with me and show me what plants, birds, and animals you can whenever we go ashore. I will give you an able seaman's wages and ask Captain Pullings to enter you as a supernumerary."
"Happy, sir. Very happy,"
said Square, and they shook hands upon it. After another 100 yards and some thought, Dr. Maturin said, "There seemed to be an elegant swamp the other side of the town. If I can deal with my rounds early enough, we might go there this afternoon, and in the following days we may ascend the lofty hill beyond." Captain Pullings was quite willing to take Square aboard as a supernumerary for victuals, though not for tobacco, or the purser would grizzle and moan for the rest of the commission, and he said he might stow his canoe in the jolly boat, as being more suitable for landing the doctor on so rough a coast. This was most satisfactory. So was the almost universal cheerfulness as the boats came alongside to carry the Liberty men ashore. There were a few anonymous hoots of, "What cheer, old Saturnino?" a nickname given him by some dissolute Maltese hands, but generally it was smiles and nods, yesterday's vehement feelings quite forgotten, while many of his older shipmates asked what they might bring him back. Yet his rounds were less so. The great cannonade may not have killed all the slavers aboard the Nancy, an article of belief throughout Freetown, but it had certainly mangled several of the more impetuous and less nimble first voyagers belonging to the squadron, in spite of their frequent exercise, and although the Bellona's sick berth was as clean and airy as that of any line of battleship in the fleet, the singular, damp, oppressive heat was not well suited to those who had to lie there. Wind sails there were, well spread and efficient wind sails, but they could not make the air they brought down any fresher than it was on the deck, where people walked about panting and mopping themselves. Several of the wounds and burns threatened to turn ugly, and after dinner, a dinner eaten in the gasping wardroom, for Jack and his captains were all invited by the governor, and which consisted for the main part of steak and kidney pudding, Stephen returned for another session with his assistants, amiable young men, but slow, lacking in experience. This went on until, just as he was administering a last soothing draught of hellebore, Stephen heard the sound of a returning barge, the wail of bosun's calls as the commodore and captain were piped aboard, the thump and clash of marines presenting arms. "There, gentlemen," he said, "now I believe we may allow the berth to take a little rest. Evans," he said to the lob lolly boy, an aged farrier who had run away to sea, escaping from a devilish shrew, "you will call Mr. Smith at the least emergency. For my own part," he added, "I mean to view the swamp behind the town." "Well, my dear, and so you are back, I find," he said, walking into the great cabin, where Jack was sitting at the stern window in his shirt sleeves, with his breeches undone at the knees and waist. "I trust you enjoyed your dinner?"
"James Wood did as proud as Pontius Pilate, bless him," said Jack. 4 hours and never without a glass in my hand. Though, Lord, sometimes I feel I am no longer 20. Perhaps it is the heat. Don't you find it damnation hot? Damp, close, oppressive? I suppose not, since you have a coat on."
"I do not find the heat exorbitant or disagreeable, though I admit the dampness. You portly subjects feel it more than we spare men, men of a more elegant shape. But take comfort. They tell me that the dry season is at hand, when the air, though hotter by far on occasion, is perfectly dry, so dry that the blacks anoint themselves with palm oil to prevent their skins from cracking, or in default of palm oil, with tallow. Dry, and sometimes accompanied by an interesting wind, the harmattan, though that may also be the name of the season itself. As for my coat, I wear it because I mean to view the swamp behind the town and do not choose to risk the falling damps.
My dear Stephen, what are you thinking of? Have you forgot your orders that no one was to go ashore after sunset? Though, by the way, you never told us why. It could not be the falling damps, since there are no falling damps in taverns or bawdy houses, which is where sailors go by instinct, like the hart to the water brook.
It is because of the miasmata.
Are they like miasmas?
Much the same, I do assure you, Jack, and they are at their worst after sunset.
Look at him now, said Jack, nodding westwards through the stern window where the sun glowed red, his brilliance dimmed by the thick and heavy air. He will be down before you have contemplated your swamp for 5 minutes. No Stephen Fairsfair, you know. You cannot deny all hands liberty and then go rioting among the owls and night birds yourself.
Jack's total sincerity and conviction overcame Stephen's protests. His cries of special cases, inherent exceptions to be understood, certain qualifications to be taken for granted. And eventually he said,
Well, I should not have seen much anyhow, and there is always tomorrow.
Stephen, said Jack, I grieve to say it, but as far as your great dismal swamp is concerned, there is no tomorrow. We weigh at the turn of the tide. The governor says that with this wind, the news of our coming and of our capers cannot yet have reached Phillip's Island, that there are several slavers due there to complete their cargoes, and that we may catch them in the act of doing so.
Oh, indeed, said Stephen, taken aback.
We must take every possible advantage before the whole coast is warned. There is not a moment to lose, and as soon as the tide turns we can stem the current and stand out of the bay.
Stephen could not but agree, and after a moment's cursing of his own tongue for its absolute domineering prating folly, its lack of ponderation and decent restraint which would have led to provisos, to certain exemptions for the common good, he took a turn on deck, where he was comforted first by an uncommonly numerous school of flying fish that skimmed well above the surface, quite high in the air, there to be snapped up in the fading light by the frigate birds, darting and flashing among them with breathtaking rapidity. And second, by the fact that the Phillip Island River was a fine stream, well known to Square, who said that although at the height of the rainy season it flowed broad and fast, lapping far in among the forest trees, making a fall at its mouth and a great bar, once the very heavy rains were over it began to shrink, leaving a clear bank along which one could walk through the forest, where chimpanzees were often to be seen, and beyond into the more open country, much frequented by elephants. He had also spoken of a small plain above the second set of falls, almost entirely covered by baobabs, in which there lived 14 different kinds of bat, some huge, with monstrous faces. He was reflecting upon the delightful possibilities, the West African eagle owl, the blue plantain eater, the many brilliant weavers and sunbirds, conceivably even the potto, when he heard the cry,
"All hands to weigh anchor!"
An unexpected order that was instantly followed by the boatswain's call and the powerful voices of his mates roaring,
"All hands to weigh anchor!"
down the hatchways, and he hurried off to be out of the way. Well did he know the frightful eagerness and activity set off by this command, the swarms of men racing across the deck regardless of those who might be in their path, the cries, the stretching forth of ropes. Coming into the cabin, he found Jack sitting placidly on a locker, treating his fiddle to a fresh set of strings.
"Why, Stephen," he said, looking up, "I was so sorry to dash your spirits about the fetid swamp. But I dare say the miasma would have done you as much harm as an ordinary unlearned cove."
"Not at all, my dear," said Stephen. "I contemplated on the delights of the Sinon, the river that comes down by Phillip's Island. I reflected upon the variety of vegetables and animals, of the very real possibility of a potto, and soon recovered my native ebullience."
"What is a potto?"
"It is a little furry creature that sleeps all day curled up in a ball with its head between its legs and then walks about very, very slowly all night high in the trees, slowly eating leaves and creeping up on birds as they roost and eating them too. It has immense eyes, which is but reasonable. Some call it the sluggard, some the slow lemur, some the sloth, but quite erroneously, for the two have nothing in common but their modest demeanour, their inoffensive lives. The potto is the most interesting of the primates from the anatomical point of view. Adamson saw and dissected the potto, and I fairly longed to have the same happiness."
"Adamson of the Thetis?"
"No, no, Adamson with an N, a Frenchman, though to be sure he was of Scotch origin. Surely, Jack, I have told you of Adamson?"
"I believe you have mentioned the gentleman's name,"
said Jack, concentrating on the peg of his D-string, always awkward and cross-grained in this rough, old sea-going instrument, above all in damp weather. He was a very great naturalist, as zealous, prolific, and industrious as he was unfortunate. I knew him in Paris when I was young, and admired him extremely. So did Cuvier. At that time he was already a member of the Académie des Sciences, but he was very kind to us. When he was little more than a youth, he went to Senegal, stayed there 5 or 6 years, observing, collecting, dissecting, describing, and classifying, and he summarized all this in a brief but eminently respectable natural history of the country, from which I learned almost everything I know of the African flora and fauna. A valuable book indeed, and the outcome of intense and long-sustained effort. But I can scarcely venture to name it on the same day as his maximum opus, 27 large volumes devoted to a systematic account of created beings and substances and the relations between them, together with 150 volumes more of index, exact scientific description, separate treatises and a vocabulary. 150 volumes, Jack, with 40,000 drawings and 30,000 specimens. All this he showed to the Academy. It was much praised, but never published. Yet he continued working on it in poverty and old age, and I like to think he was happy in his immense design, and with the admiration of such men as Jussieu and the Institut in general.
"I'm sure he was," said Jack. "We are underway," he cried, as the ship took on a fresh, more lively motion,
and Stephen, following his gaze astern, saw the Thames, Aurora, and Camilla drop their topsails and fetch the Bellona's wake as the squadron, headed by the Stately, moved southeastwards into the coming night and a sudden, violent squall of rain. Jack tuned his restrung fiddle. They talked for a while about pitch, and how some people maintained that A should sound thus. Jack played the note and said,
"I cannot bear it. I hate to think that our grandfathers should be such flats."
After a moment, he chuckled, reflecting upon the double meaning of the word, and said,
"That was pretty good, Stephen, don't you think? Such flats. You smoked it, of course. But can you think of Corelli playing in that moaning, small beer and water kind of wine?"
Then, changing his tone entirely, he went on,
"I tell you what, Stephen, being tantamount to a flag officer is very hard work, infinitely solitary care and toil, and if your expedition don't answer the expectations of a parcel of coves that have never been to sea in their lives, you are flogged to death and buried at the crossroads with a stake through your heart. But it has its compensations. There is Tom and everybody else aboard, everybody in all His Majesty's ships and vessels under my command, skipping about, getting wet. Look how it is coming down now. Hauling aft, tally and belay, laying aloft, coiling down. Bees ain't in it, while we sit here like fine gentlemen. Ha, ha, ha! Come, she's on an even keel now. Let me call for lights, fetch your cello, and we'll have a tune."
At 4:30 in the morning, Stephen was woken by an agitated Mr. Smith. Abel Black, for topman, starboard watch, a perfectly ordinary cracked fibula, had stumbled over a misplaced bucket in the dark, was on the point of bursting. There had been retention of urine from a wholly unrelated cause, a common calculus, ever since he was brought below, but he was a shamefaced man, and being far from his messmates, lying there between a couple of unknown larbelings belonging to the afterguard, he had not liked to mention it early on, while in the night watches he had not liked to disturb the doctors, and now modesty had brought him to a very elegant pass indeed. Stephen knew the condition well, a frequent concomitant of some other seamen's maladies. He was also used to dealing with sailors' wonderfully uneven and complex forms of delicacy, and having dealt with the situation for the time being, he returned to bed. But not to sleep, for just as he was well into his cot and swinging easy, some dreadful voice from the depths said,
"Maturin, Maturin, you had already bored poor Jack Aubrey cruelly with your tedious account of Michel Adanson years ago, prating away in the same earnest, even enthusiastic, moral-improving fashion for 30 minutes on end, and he sitting there smiling and nodding politely, saying, 'Oh, indeed,' and 'Heavens above, oh, for shame! You may well blush, but blushing does no good. It is mere remorse of conscience.'"
He could not recall the longitude or latitude in which he had done this, nor even in what ocean, but he could hear the sound of his own zealous voice going on and on and on, and Jack's civil replies.
"Do I often do this?" he asked in the darkness. "Is it habitual, God forbid, or only advancing age? He is a dear, well-bred man, the creature, but will my heart ever forgive him this moral advantage?"
He slept at last, but the recollection was with him, strong and fresh, when he woke. To dispel it he washed and shaved with particular care. It was, after all, Sunday, and went on deck to take the air. To his astonishment, there was no land at all to be seen to larboard, nor any of the smaller vessels. The squadron now consisted of the two-deckers and the frigates, and they were all in a beautifully exact, evenly spaced line, standing somewhat west of south under t'gansels, with the breeze 1 or 2 points free. As he stood there, a midshipman reported his reading of the log.
8 knots and half a fathom, sir, if you please. And Mr. Woodbine reckons the current due easterly a full knot.
The officer, Mr. Miller, made some reply, but Stephen missed it, his attention being wholly taken up by an eddy of wind from the forecourse that brought the scent of coffee and toast, of bacon and, perhaps, of flying fish freshly fried. He hurried aft. He had meant to give himself a certain countenance by repeating the pace of the ship and the current, but greed and affection overcame him, and he cried,
"Good morning, Jack. God and Mary be with you, and would that be flying fish freshly fried at all?"
"A very good morning to you, Stephen. Yes, it is. Pray let me help you to a pair."
"Jack," said Stephen after a while, "I was astonished to see neither land nor the mass of our smaller companions. Would it be improper to ask how this can have come about? Have they lost their way in the dark at last? It is but too probable."
"I am afraid so," said Jack. "Yet I am sure that at least one of them had a compass aboard. And in any event, if it is broke, they can always follow our light. We have 3 splendid green lanterns behind, as you have no doubt observed, and I dare say someone lit them."
He raised his voice.
"Killick! Killick there! Light along another pot of coffee, will you?"
"Which I already got it in my hand, ain't I?"
said Killick outside the door.
"Another cup, Stephen?"
"If you please."
"We separated when the breeze shifted 3 points in the middle watch, the brigs and schooners keeping so much closer to the wind as sailing right along the coast for Phillip's Island when they can, and beating when they can't. They are followed by Laurel and Camilla, a little farther offshore, and we are making a long southwesterly leg, meaning to go about in the afternoon watch, strike the coast beyond the island, and snap up any brutes that might be trying to escape, or to bear a hand if there is any trouble in the harbour, which I doubt."
Stephen digested this for a while, and then he said,
"Jack, last night it suddenly came to me that I had told you all about Adanson before, and at great length, his assiduity, his countless books, his misfortune. I beg your pardon. There is nothing more profoundly boring, more deeply saddening, than a repeated tale."
"I am sure you are right in general, but I do assure you, Stephen, that in this case I never noticed it. To tell the truth, I was so much taken up with my D-string, which kept slipping, that I was afraid you might think my inattention uncivil. Yet I tell you what it is, Stephen. I have been talking with Hewell, and I have decided upon my plan of campaign. Should you like to hear it?"
"If you please."
"Well, it has long seemed to me, and both Hewell and all the officers who are at Sherborough and beyond confirm it, that this is essentially an inshore task, and that there is no place at all for ships of the line, or even for frigates, unless they are as fast and weatherly as Surprise. No place except for the same purpose as those cricket players who scout out a great way off, like the long stop or the long field off. I mean far out at sea and to the windward of likely routes of escape, particularly towards the Havana. It is no use lying within sight of the shore. Our tall masts can be seen a great way off, all the more since they had watches stationed on the heights and in very tall trees when the preventive squadron was here, and will have again as soon as they hear of our arrival. On the whole, black men see far better than we do, you know."
"Sure, I have observed it."
"So as soon as we have dealt with Phillip's Island, I am going to station the 2 deckers and Thames well out to sea, far out of sight of the shore, but within signalling distance of one another and of smaller craft interposed. This can cover a most surprising area. At the same time, the others will work right along the coast, moving as fast as ever they can to keep ahead of the news that we are here, right along the coast, while we keep pace offshore, from Cape Palmas to the Bight of Benin."
"Beware and take care of the Bight of Benin. There's one comes out, for 40 goes in," Stephen chanted.
"What a fellow you are, Stephen," cried Jack, in a tone of real displeasure. "How can you think of singing, or groaning, a foolish, unlucky old song like that, aboard a ship that is going to the Bight? I wonder at it after so many years at sea."
"Why, Jack, I am sorry to have offended you. The dear knows where I heard it. The words rose of themselves by mere association, but I shall not sing it again, I promise you."
"It is not that I am in the least degree superstitious," said Jack, far from mollified, "but everyone who knows anything about the sea knows it is a song sung in ships that have come out of the Bight, by way of making game of those that are going in. Do not sing it again until we are homeward bound, I beg. It might bring bad luck, and it is certain to upset the hands.
I am very sorry for it. So I am, too. I shall never do so again. But tell me about this bight, Jack. Are there sirens along its shores, or terrible reefs? And where is it at all?
I will show you exactly on the charts in the master's day cabin when we pass, said Jack. But for the moment, reaching for paper and pencil, here is a rough idea. I leave the grain coast to one side, because the noise we did make at Sherborough and that we shall make at Phillips Island will raise the whole country. But here, going east, is the Ivory Coast, with several promising estuaries and lagoons. Then we carry on steadily east and a little north of east, right into the Gulf, coming to the Gold Coast with places like Dick's Cove and Secondi, and the Cape Coast Castle and Winneba, all great markets, and so on to the Slave Coast in this great bay, which is the Bight of Benin itself. The Bight of Biafra is farther on, where the winds grow very troublesome, and there is a strong current setting east. The fever very bad, too. Wretched waters, except for fore-and-aft vessels. But that is where so many slavers go, to Grand Popo and Whydah. I do not think we can go much beyond Whydah, however, though in the mangrove country beyond there is brass and bonny and the Calabars, old and new. But by then I think we shall have to stand out if ever we can, stand due south for the line, and pick up the southeast trades about St. Thomas's Island, which is clear of the bights and their calms and false breezes. That is my plan, though I forgot to say that Ringle and the schooner Active will ply inshore and off, continually reporting either directly or by signal to Camilla or Laurel to repeat the pennant, since they will lie between us and the inshore craft. And, by the way, I'm going to break poor Dick's heart by making him change his fine, tall man-of-war's topmast for wretched t'gallant poles, the same for Camilla, so that the watchers on shore will take them for common merchantmen.
Then, as I understand it, said Stephen, paying no attention to Captain Richardson's coming distress, this vessel, this Bellona, is not even to see the coast throughout the entire expedition.
Only in the very unlikely case of a row that the brigs and Camilla and Laurel, mounting 60 guns and more between them, cannot deal with. Though, of course, one might catch the odd glimpse of mountains from the t'gallant cross-trees from time to time.
Stephen turned away, his arm over the back of his chair.
You are grieving about your Potto, I'm afraid, said Jack after an awkward silence. But you will have a fine run ashore tomorrow, when we have dealt with whatever is lying in the harbour of Phillips Island. And I dare say you could go in occasionally, when the Ringle comes out to report, or carry orders back. Though if it comes to that, you could always exchange with a surgeon of Camilla, Laurel, or one of the inshore brigs.
No, they have tied me to a stake. I cannot fly, but bear-like I must fight the course, said Stephen, with a creditable smile. Not a very dreadful course, for all love. It is only that I was so extravagantly indulged in the East Indies and New Holland and Peru. No, not at all. Now one more cup of coffee, and I must attend to my calculus, nearly always a difficult subject.
So you have suddenly taken to the calculus, cried Jack. How very glad I am. Amazed. Quite stunned. By just calculus, I take it you mean the differential, rather than the infinitesimal. If I can be of any help...
You are very good, my dear, said Stephen, putting down his cup and rising. But I mean the vesicle calculus no more, what is commonly known as a stone in the bladder. The utmost reach of my mathematics. I must be away.
Oh,
said Jack, feeling oddly dashed.
You will not forget it is Sunday,
he called after Stephen's back. There was little likelihood of Stephen's being able to forget that it was Sunday, for not only did Killick take away and hide his newly curled and powdered best wig, his newly brushed second-best coat and breeches, but the loblolly boy said,
Asking your pardon, sir, but you ain't forgot it is Sunday.
While both his assistants, separately and tactfully, asked him whether he had remembered it.
As though I were a brute beast, unable to tell good from evil, Sunday from common days of the week, he exclaimed. But his indignation was tempered by a consciousness that he had in fact risen from his cot unaware of this interesting distinction, and that he had shaved close by mere chance.
Yet I should very soon have made it out, he said.
The atmosphere aboard a Sunday man-of-war is entirely different.
Indeed it was, with 500 or 600 men washing, shaving, or being shaved, plaiting their time-mates' pigtails, drawing clean hammocks, putting on their best clothes for mustering by divisions, and then church, all in great haste, all in a bitterly confined space, with a heat and humidity great enough to hatch eggs, and all after having brought the ship and everything visible in her to an exemplary state of cleanliness, if wooden, and of brilliance, if metal. The Anglican aspect of Sunday did not affect Stephen, but the ritual cleanliness did, and he, with his assistants and Lob Lollyboy, were present, sober, and properly dressed, with their instruments laid out all agleam and their patients rigidly straight in their cots, when Captain Pullings and his first lieutenant, Mr. Harding, came round to inspect them. So did the convention of the captain, dining with his officers, but this did not take place until after church had been rigged. An awning shaded the quarter-deck, an ensign over an arms-chest to serve as a lectern, from which prayers and sermons were delivered if the ship carried a chaplain, which the Bellona did not, or by the captain. Though a captain might well prefer reading the Articles of War. Stephen therefore had time, after the inspection of the sick berth, to make his way to the poop, where he had a fine view of the Royal Marines, close on 100 of them, drawn up exactly in their scarlet and pipe-clayed glory, and of the long, somewhat more wavering lines of seamen, clean and trim, standing in their easy, round-shouldered way, covering the decks fore and aft, a sight that always gave him a certain pleasure. During the service itself he joined other Catholics for a recital of a St. Brigid's rosary under the forecastle. They were of all possible colours and origins, and some were momentarily confused by the unusual number of aves. But wherever they came from, their Latin was recognisably the same. There was a sense of being at home, and they recited away in an agreeable unison, while from aft came the sound of Anglican hymns and a psalm. They both finished at about the same time, and Stephen walked back to the quarter-deck, overtaking Captain Pullings as he was walking into the coach, where he lived, necessarily resigning the cabin to the Commodore.
"Well, Tom," he said, "so you have survived your ordeal?"
As captain of the Bellona, he had just read one of South's shorter sermons to the people.
"I have, sir. It comes a little easier, as you said, but sometimes I wish we were just a pack of wicked heathens. Lord, I could do with my dinner. And a drink."
Dinner, when it came, was quite exceptionally good, and for the best part of an hour before the Bellona's officers and their guests sat down, a hot wind had been blowing off the land. Hot, but startlingly dry, so that their uniforms no longer clung to them and their appetites revived amazingly.
"This is the first blast of the dry season," said Hugh, talking to Stephen across the table. "The two will chop and change for about a week or two, and then I dare say we shall have a right harmattan, the decks covered with brown dust and everything splitting, and then it settles in till Lady Day."
The conversation ran on dry seasons, far better than wet, the delight of satisfying an enormous thirst, and presently Stephen, turning to his right-hand neighbour, a marine lieutenant from the Stately, said how he admired the soldiers' endurance of either extreme, standing there like images, in the sun or the bitter cold, or marching, wheeling, and counter-marching with such perfect regularity.
"There is something wonderfully agreeable in the sight of that self-command, or one might almost say relinquishment of self, in that formal rhythmic precision, the tuck of drum, the stamp and clash of arms. Whether it has anything to do with war or not, I cannot tell, but the spectacle delights me."
"Oh, I agree with you, sir," said the marine. "And it has always seemed to me that there is something far more to drill than simply training in steadiness and obedience to the word of command. Little do I know of the Pyrrhic dance, yet it pleases me to imagine that it was in the nature of our manoeuvres, only with a clearly acknowledged rather than a dimly perceived sacred function. The foot guards offer a fine example of what I mean when they troop their colours."
"The religious element in dancing can scarcely be denied. After all, David danced before the Ark of the Covenant. In those parts of Spain where the Mozarabic rite is preserved, a measured dance still forms part of the mass."
Here Stephen was called upon to drink a glass of wine with Captain Pullings, while his neighbour joined an animated discussion on the preservation of game at the other end of the table. The meal wound on. The first lieutenant carved a saddle of mutton, and then a leg, in a way that did the Bellona credit, and the claret decanters pursued their steady round. Yet, presently, even the subject of putting down pheasants and circumventing poachers was exhausted, and Stephen, finding his marine disengaged, said,
"One thing that I do remember about the Pyrrhic dance is that it was danced in armour."
"I'm happy to hear you say so, sir," said the young man with a smile,
a strikingly handsome young man, "for it strengthens my point since we do the same. To be sure, we admit the degeneration that has taken place since Hector and Lysander, and we have reduced our equipment in due proportion, but, mutatis mutandis, we still drill or dance in armour."
"Do you indeed?" cried Stephen. "I had never noticed it."
"Why, this, sir," said the Royal Marine, tapping his gorget,
a little silver crescent hanging on the front of his red coat. "This is the breastplate. Somewhat smaller than the breastplate Achilles wore, but then so are our deserts." He laughed very cheerfully, seizing a decanter on the wing, filled Stephen's glass and his own. He had not drunk the half before Tom Pullings held up his hand, and in a dead silence the cry from the masthead was repeated, coming down clear and plain through the open hatchways and gun ports.
"On deck there! Land ho! Land broad on the larboard bow!"
"Mr. Harding, you will excuse me. I must acquaint the Commodore. Gentlemen, pray carry on with your dinner. In case I do not come back, thank you all for your hospitality." He did not come back, and since there was little point in leaving their meat to see very distant land, they did carry on. The hot, almost parching wind was blowing stronger, and although some officers called for negus or lemon shrub, others quenched their rising thirst with claret, and a fresh dozen had to be brought up. In time, with the absence of the captain and the presence of a newly promoted first lieutenant with little natural authority, the talk grew louder and much more free. Stephen and his marine had to raise their voices for their words to be heard at all, words still connected with such things as the formal dancing of the last age in France, and with drill as applied to cavalry and whole fleets. And Stephen was disagreeably aware that his neighbour was drinking, had drunk too much, and that his attention had wandered to the conversation at the purser's end, where they were talking, often several at once, about sodomy.
"You may say what you like," said the tall, thin lieutenant, second of the Thames, "but they are never really men. They may have pretty ways and read books and so on, but they will not toe the scratch in a fight. I had two in a gun crew when I was a mid in Britannia, and when things grew rather hot, they hid between the scuttle-butt and the capstan."
Other views were heard, other convictions and experiences, some tolerant, even benign, but most more or less violently opposed to sodomites.
"In this atmosphere I scarcely think it would be worth mentioning Patroclus or the Theban Legion," murmured Stephen, but the marine was too intent on the general medley of voices to pay attention. He filled another glass and drank it without taking his eyes from the group round the purser.
"You may say what you like," said the tall, thin lieutenant, "but even if I had the same tastes, I should be very sorry to have to go into action aboard a ship commanded by one of them, however stately." "If that is a fling against my ship, sir," cried the marine, pushing his chair back and standing up, very pale, "I must ask you to withdraw it at once. The stately's fighting qualities admit no sort of question."
"I was not aware that you belonged to Stately, sir," said the lieutenant.
"I see that there are others who do not choose to toe the scratch," said the marine,
and now there was a general movement to separate the two men, general clamour, general extreme concern. Eventually both were put into their separate boats, the Stately's most unhappily manned by some of her captain's young ladies. Already the land was high and clear. The hot wind blew as strong and as fair as could be wished, and the Bellona, Stately, and Thames were nearing the point at which they should cut off any fugitive escaping from Phillip's Island. But already signals were passing from the inshore brigs to the pennant by way of the Laurel. There were no fugitives to be cut off. The harbour was empty. The slavers were not to appear for 3 days, they having been delayed at Tacondi, and although the barracoons, the great slave pens, had held many negroes when the inshore force arrived, they had now been marched off. Jack Aubrey altered course, and by the grace of the tide and the evening breeze, his three ships ran straight into the harbour, conned by Square, who knew the inlets and anchorages intimately well. The signal for all captains broke out aboard the Bellona before her anchor was down, and the boats converged upon her in the brief tropical dust. After he had conferred with them, he said to Stephen,
"I intend to stand out to sea again, out of sight, sending the brigs and schooners east along the coast to the Moonee Lagoon, to stop any coastwise boats or canoes that might carry warning, and to lay those fellows aboard as soon as they are here in the harbour. According to Hewell's predictions and to Square's, a capital seaman that Square, and to the barometer, there is a very fair chance of our catching them, 3 Dutchmen and a Dane, bound for the Havana. So if you like to go ashore this evening with Square, you could have a couple of days naturalizing along your river. There is a little crew village where you could pass the night, but you would have to be here on the shore and ready to put off without the loss of a minute at high tide on Wednesday."
"What time would that be?"
asked Stephen, glowing inwardly.
"Why, it's 7 in the evening, of course,"
said Jack, rather impatiently. Even now he found Stephen's inability to adapt his mind to the rhythm of moon and tide barely credible in a man of his parts. He paused, considered, and then in quite a different tone he went on,
"Yet, Stephen, I cannot but remember what you said about no shore leave at Freetown after sunset because of miasmas and noxious exhalations, and I do beg you will take the utmost care. Stay indoors and walk out only when the day is aired."
"Thank you for your care of me, my dear," said Stephen. "But never let the climate grieve your generous heart. Freetown has a deathly fever swamp at hand. Even horses cannot live long in Freetown. But I shall be walking by a broad, brisk river with falls, and miasmata are not to be feared by running water. It is your stagnant pool that engenders fever. Now I must arrange my collecting bags and paper sheets. Choose proper garments. Are there leeches? Consult with honest Square and plan our route. In 2 days, going steady, we might pass his plain with baobabs and monstrous bats, and reach the country of the Potto and Temminck's pangolin.